Ladies and gentlemen, if I could just have your attention, please, so we can get proceedings underway. Good afternoon and welcome to the FCC. My name is Tim Huxley. I'm the treasurer of this great institution, and it's a great pleasure to have you here. A couple of housekeeping things to start with. If you could all switch off mobile phones, pagers, whatever, please do so. And I'd just like to advise you of a couple of upcoming events. Next Wednesday, the 27th, we're delighted to welcome Pavin Chachavalpongpun, who's the Associate Professor of Kyoto University, who will be talking on the subject of Coup King Crisis, What Next for Thailand. And on June the 1st, we will have in the evening a documentary screening, the latest installment of veteran correspondent Mike Chinoy's Assignment China series, which will be A Tale of Two Chinas. So we look forward to seeing you then. Today, we're delighted to welcome back to the FCC Professor Charlie Jeffrey, the Senior Vice Principal and the Chair of Politics at the University of Edinburgh. As so many of you remember, Professor Jeffrey spoke here last year immediately after the Scottish referendum, and today he is going to talk to us about what was the most unpredictable election in living memory. Well, that's what all the pollsters said it was going to be, with the outcome, judging by the enthusiastic reception down in the main bar at breakfast on election day, suggested that a lot of people in Hong Kong were reasonably comfortable with the result. So I'm delighted to hand over to Charlie, who will bring us up to date on UK politics. Charlie.
Thank you very much indeed, Tim. It's a great pleasure to be introduced by an alumnus of the University of Edinburgh. And it's nice to welcome other alumni who are also here, as well as more generally the members of the club. I have my tie on, so I'm demonstrating that it is my second appearance. It's great to be back here. One brief apology in advance. I had an unexpectedly long time last night in Hangzhou Airport, where I was putting the final touches to this presentation, and there were many absences in Hangzhou Airport, which you notice when you're there for 5 or 6 hours longer than you intended to be. Things like flight delay announcements, food concessions, and working internet connections. So one or two of my slides are a bit flakier than I would normally like them to be, so apologies for that. So yes, it was an extraordinary election with a quite unexpected outcome. Here it is. We have an overall majority for the Conservative Party, a triumph for David Cameron. No sitting Prime Minister has both increased share of vote and seats for decades. Not by much, as you can see, just a marginal increase in vote, not that many more seats. Labour also went up a bit, but lost out in terms of seats, not least because of its decimation in Scotland at the hands of the SNP. You see that plus 50 figure there against the SNP, which is quite extraordinary. Just below it, you see something else extraordinary, which is the minus 49 for the Liberal Democrats, utterly decimated across the UK. See that the Greens increased their vote.
Sorry, can I ask quickly, because I'm Australian, and I apologise if I don't know. Were the 49 votes elderly Danes in Scotland, or were they...
These are the UK-wide results. I'll show you Scotland's in a moment specifically, and England's later on too. So UK-wide, the Greens increased their vote a bit, but no more seats. UKIP... had a pretty notable result, 12.6%. That's almost 4 million voters for the UK Independence Party, now the third party by popular support, but only one seat. They actually had over 120 second places, which were pretty evenly spread around England. north and south and extending into Wales. You might say that if UKIP was a party of stability and good organisation, it could be around for some time, but I suspect it's probably neither of those things. Modest change in Wales and Northern Ireland, so I'm not going to talk about them. I will talk about Scotland, though. An extraordinary result. These are the Scotland-only results, where you see again that SNP astonishing victory. Plus 50. 56 out of 59 seats. That's 95% of seats in Scotland. We have a peculiar form of political measurement in Scotland, which has to do with the fact that these lovely two pandas now reside in Edinburgh Zoo. We measure political parties against the total of pandas in Scotland, and we now have three political parties with fewer MPs than pandas in Scotland. That's David Mundell, the Conservative Party's sole representative in Scotland. Ian Murray, he's my MP, Edinburgh South, Labour's last remaining representative in Scotland, the last of the 41 that Labour had. And here is Alistair Carmichael, clearly metaphorically shooting himself in his dismay at being the last Liberal Democrat standing in Scotland. So Labour minus 40, SNP plus 50. The SNP was about 5,000 votes across Scotland short of an absolute clean sweep. The national swing to the SNP was 24%, an absolute record, nothing like that in history. And we had an interesting evening looking at constituency level swings. I was on BBC Scotland all night, talking early on in the evening when one of the first Scottish results came through. It was an 18% swing to the SNP in Kilmarnock. So there was a discussion about what would be the record swing ever at constituency level. I looked it up, it was 21.8%. That got beaten a few minutes later, and it got beaten, and it got beaten, and it got beaten until it broke that fantastic British election institution, the swingometer. Now here is the biggest swing. In Glasgow North East, it required actually a 26% swing to the SNP to take it from Labour. They got 39.3, and you can see that the BBC's graphic could not accommodate a swing that big, so the 39 is concealed by the scale of the swing. So an election that broke the swingometer. So extraordinary in Scotland, pretty extraordinary in England as well. What you see here are the England-only results. You can see that the Conservative Party has 319 out of 533 seats, 60% of England's seats, so a clear majority party in England. And you can see here that Labour did really rather disappointingly across England, a very small recovery from one of its worst ever results in England in 2010. Now, there was a lot of recrimination in the Labour Party about how Scotland had lost it for the party. That's nonsense. Labour lost this election above all because it was unable to win sufficient support in England. Those of you who have been around for a while will remember Tony Blair's first landslide in 1997. One of the iconic moments was the defeat of Michael Portillo in Enfield Southgate. And one of the slogans of that election was, "Were you still up for Portillo?" Well, this time it's, "Were you still up for Ed Balls?" Here you can see him being declared the loser in Morley in Leeds at 8:30 in the morning. Ed Ball's defeat is a confirmation that Labour lost that election in England. One of the remarkable things about how the Conservatives played the election was that they had an English campaign for the first time. They presented themselves specifically in England as an English party. They promised to introduce English votes on English laws, known by its acronym of EVIL. That is to produce special procedures in the House of Commons to deal with England-only business. As part of that, they would have an English rate of income tax. They announced an English manifesto during the campaign. They didn't write it down anywhere, but they just said this is an English manifesto, which included something called the Carlisle Principle, which would be an annual statement of all the damaging things the Scottish Parliament had done with consequences for England. In other words, they were presenting themselves as the defenders of England, in particular against Scotland. And we saw imagery such as this. This is Nicola Sturgeon, the Scottish First Minister, with an Ed Miliband puppet. And rather famously, we had Alex Salmond with Ed Miliband in his jacket pocket. You might say that this election has outed the Conservative Party as England's national party, now ranged against Scotland's national party. One of the big questions will be how those two national parties will work together. This was an unexpected outcome. The opinion polls had predicted a neck-and-neck outcome between the Conservative Party and the Labour Party. Apologies for the fuzziness of this. This is all the election, all the opinion polls back to the last election, so lots and lots of data points. But you can see that the fuzzy red line and the fuzzy blue line were pretty much neck and neck as the election approached. And if you can read the numbers, it had the Conservatives ahead of Labour by 0.6 of 1%, 34.7 to 34.1. They actually came out in the lead by 6%. All of the expectations beforehand had been of a Labour-led government under Ed Miliband, supported by the SNP and perhaps others. This was way wrong. And here's an example. This is a projection produced by very clever political scientists at the University of Oxford who got it wrong. Wouldn't find political scientists at the University of Edinburgh doing things like this. This is their projection of the possibilities of government formation, published on the day of the election. This is their forecast. Labour Prime Minister, well, there's a 58% probability of a Labour Prime Minister working with the SNP and perhaps others. And you can see just at about between 12 and 1 o'clock the likelihood of a Conservative majority at 6%. Whoops. However, the polling did get Scotland right. This is the outcome of the very final poll of polls, the average of the last sequence of opinion polls in Scotland on the 7th of May, and you can see that it got the SNP at 49, where they scored 50, slightly over for Labour, slightly under for the Lib Dems, bang on for the Conservatives. So the polls were absolutely spot on in Scotland. Nobody believed them, though, and they were wrong in England, and everybody believed them. What we have now is an independent investigation being carried out about why the polls were so wrong. I'm sure there are plenty of newspapers which are very annoyed about having paid so much money for them to be carried out. But there may be a sense that the flawed polling shaped the debate and how people voted. If it had shown the Conservatives in the lead, then we might have had a different debate and people might have had different calculations about how they would cast their vote. So the pollsters are indeed, I think, in for a bit of a kicking. What does it all mean? Well, I think four themes for me, as set out on that slide: losers in turmoil, issues around public spending, Scotland and Europe. First of all, the losers in turmoil. We had a game of dominoes on the 8th of May. Here we have Ed Miliband going at 12:16. I've got this in slightly the wrong sequence because Nick Clegg had beaten him to it at 11:34. And then 11:25, I'm going completely the wrong direction, Nigel Farage resigned as head of UKIP. I mentioned earlier some of the features of UKIP as a party which lacks a certain coherence, and it was confirmed when he unresigned shortly afterwards. But UKIP also in some turmoil. Most of the attention, I think, is on Labour as Labour gears up for a six-month leadership campaign. The various contestants setting out their stalls. One of them, the first to declare, is already undeclared. It looks like a long, hard summer. Also for Labour in Scotland, because Jim Murphy, the Scottish Labour leader, has also at least announced his intention to resign, very grudgingly and in a very public dispute with some of the trade unions who fund the Labour Party. So, turmoil, what does that mean? Well, I think it means that the Conservatives are in an unexpectedly strong position for a party which has such a slim overall majority. The opposition isn't going to be doing much opposing in the coming months because they're going to be working out what the hell they are going to do as political parties, with one exception, and that is the SNP. The SNP, the third biggest party at Westminster, I am pretty sure that that is the party from which the most vigorous opposition to the Conservatives is going to come, at least for the first couple of years of this Parliament. And given that strength, they will be represented on all of the House of Commons committees. They will be second up after Labour every week at Prime Minister's questions. They are a fearsomely disciplined party. They will use those opportunities with great creativity and persistence. My second theme to think about is spending. This was an election in which we had the clearest choice on fiscal policy since the 1980s. Here you see spending plans by party as calculated by the Institute of Fiscal Studies. You can see the Conservatives wished to push spending down to about 36% of national income, public spending down to 36%. All of the other parties were higher than that. The Conservatives want to get the deficit to zero in 4 years. They intend to do so while keeping tax revenues stable as a percent of GDP. In fact, they gave various assurances that they would not increase income tax, national insurance, or VAT. That means they're going to cut spending, and their plan is to cut it to that level, which is a historically low level. They're going to do that while protecting spending in some fields. International aid, it's not very much. Schools, that's a lot. And health, that's enormous. All of those areas are protected. They claim they're going to get $5 billion a year from cracking down on tax avoidance. They haven't shown much success in that area in the past. And they claim they're going to whack on another $12 billion in cuts in social security, one-tenth of which has been identified so far, and the biggest item in the Social Security budget, that is pensions, is also protected. That means that everything else is going to get cut back pretty substantially. And for those benefits in the unprotected category, they will be, if those plans are carried out, back to levels last seen in 1990, 25 years ago. All of that is underpinned by quite optimistic assumptions about economic growth at 2.5%. Let's see if we achieve that. I think this is going to be difficult to deliver. If it is delivered, it will be very contentious. there will be losers. The losers will squeal. Conservative backbenchers who feel those squeals will get restive. It could get messy. Scotland. Well, the SNP went into the election expecting to be able to exert leverage over a Labour minority government. They believe the polls as well. They had three big claims. One was to increase spending. You can see them at a rather higher level there on that chart. They wanted to cancel the renewal of Trident, the nuclear weapons system, and they wanted more powers for the Scottish Parliament. They were clear that this was not an election about a new referendum. Nicola Sturgeon said on various occasions that material change would be needed before we could think about another referendum. Not exactly clear what material change means, but I'll come to an example later on. But for now, the SNP has no leverage on two of those three big ambitions. No leverage on spending. The Conservatives have a majority. They will try to pursue that spending plan as set out on that chart. And there's no leverage on Trident either. The Conservatives, plus a big chunk of the Labour Party, will support the renewal of Trident. The SNP has 56 out of 650. They can't stop it. What they can do is to press for more powers for the Scottish Parliament. Here you see a picture of Lord Smith, who convened a commission after the referendum, which brought together political parties, including the SNP, and with it a proposal to increase especially the tax and welfare powers of the Scottish Parliament. Nicola Sturgeon will now seek to push David Cameron beyond that agreement. And there is a real possibility of a deal between the two national parties. There is a possibility of a deal. You know, give Scotland more. As part of that, you begin to institutionalise England in the UK political system through English votes on English laws, where the Conservative Party is the dominant party. You could get a bargain together there, not least because both marginalise the common enemy, which is Labour. So your enemy's enemy is your friend. There should be, if people are creative, the basis of a deal. We'll see. One of the things that could throw that off, though, is Europe. David Cameron has committed to an EU referendum, which we may see as early as May next year. They'd originally thought 2017, but Germany and France have elections in that year, and I think Angela Merkel and François Hollande have said, don't have your referendum then. That wouldn't be very helpful. In addition, it is a slim majority, and I think Cameron will want to move on this while there is still a rosy memory of his victory and before an austerity government saps party discipline. Remember, the Conservatives are not a united party on Europe. Many MPs and many Conservative voters would like to be out of the EU in all circumstances. So I think Cameron will try to move quickly while he still has the authority of his victory behind him. And with those nearly 4 million votes for UKIP firmly in his mind. UKIP, a party committed unconditionally to withdrawal and pressing the Conservative Party to take a strong line on Europe. Is anything more than a cosmetic renegotiation of terms possible? I doubt it. I doubt there will be great openness among other member states for reforms which perhaps, as Cameron has suggested he would like, would undermine the principle of free movement of labour. And I suspect Cameron will probably see a pretty strong business mobilisation against withdrawal from the EU, which will make things somewhat difficult for him. What do the Brits think about all of this? Well, here's what the English think. This is from a survey I did with colleagues last year, which showed that the English just about were in favour of coming out. And you could see how that works across the party political spectrum, with the Lib Dem supporters and Labour supporters clearly for remaining in, and Conservative and UKIP supporters clearly for being out. David Cameron has got an electorate to respond to here, which he's going to find quite challenging. What may be as or more challenging is the fact that Europe divides by nation as well. These were the figures we got in April last year. We hope to do some more before summer this year, but showing that Scotland has a clearly different viewpoint on Europe than people in England and indeed Wales. Now, if you had a referendum which had a voting pattern like that, UK-wide, it would be close to 50-50, and it could put Scotland and England on different sides of the outcome. And that is, I think, the most likely source of the material change of which Nicola Sturgeon has spoken, which could open up a possibility of another Scottish referendum. So to sum up, what does it all mean? Well, the second, third and fourth biggest parties are going to be spending lots of time in the coming months working out what to do and who should lead them wherever that should go. They're going to be thinking about themselves, they're not going to be thinking about the UK. We're going to have a big debate on public spending cuts, who loses, how the burdens are distributed. Will this lead to public sector strikes, more controversies around things like the bedroom tax? Well, yes, probably. Thirdly, we're going to have a continuing debate about how the Scots should govern themselves, probably with a sub-debate about how England should govern itself. And we're going to have renewed debate about how the UK should govern itself in its European context. All of those things, I think, turn us inward. Now, when was the last significant contribution by UK government or opposition to addressing a major international issue? Greece and the future of the Eurozone, refugee crisis in Mediterranean, Ukraine, Syria, North Africa, climate change. I can't remember one. I think the image which follows probably sums up UK politics over the next 5 years. We are in for a prolonged bout of navel gazing. Tim, thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Charlie. We now throw the floor open to questions. If you'd like to raise your hand, we'll get a microphone to you. And if you could just identify yourself, and then we'll get on with it. Over here.
Hello, my name's Alison Cook. Does this also raise the question of electoral reform at all in the UK?
Yes. The problem is that those the advocates of electoral reform are not normally those who have won a majority in the Parliament and who have the means to legislate for electoral reform. But we have seen some fairly crass outcomes. The SNP is clearly overrepresented, 50% of the vote, tremendous achievement, but 95% of the seats. UKIP, nearly 13% of the vote, one out of 650. The Liberal Democrats also underrepresented. It is a system, an electoral system, which does not produce anything like an outcome proportional to how people vote. And that normally gets complained about by those who lose elections who can't do anything about it. And that's where we are.
Hello, my name's Sally Johnson. I just wanted to ask you, and particularly that you were watching this from Scotland, during the election campaign, Ed Miliband was forced, first of all, into making some austerity measures of his own with his Edstone, and second, he was forced to say that he wouldn't make a pact with the SNP. What's your assessment? How many of those SNP votes are actually nationalist votes, or how many of them are left-wing Labour votes or anti-English Labour Party votes? Are they real nationalists, do you think?
There's a number of levels on which to answer that. I don't think you can read that vote as a vote about Scotland's constitutional position within the UK in respect to independence. I think there are a lot of people who voted Labour who are not instinctive independence supporters. I think the I think the SNP worked very hard with a rhetoric about social justice and maintaining public spending at a higher level to protect public services, which was very much focused on keeping close to them people in the west of Scotland who had voted yes last year, but who had traditionally voted Labour. I think the scale of their success is above all about having a strong voice at Westminster, and the scale of Labour's defeat is a sense among Scots that Labour is incapable of providing that voice, and I think that was underlined by Ed Miliband's evident lack of resonance at all in Scotland. I don't think Miliband sought to learn about Scotland very much. He certainly didn't understand Scotland, and he didn't understand the differential challenge that the Labour Party has in Scotland, where the Conservatives are not the opponents. The SNP are the opponents. And Labour will need to realise that if it is to recover in Scotland.
Hi, Alistair Hetherington. What does David Cameron think about Europe? Does he want to be in or out, or does he just want a solution that gets him re-elected for a third term? And can the SNP sustain this level of share of vote going into the next general election?
David Cameron has been clear that he would like the UK to stay in the EU. He would like to have something he can call a renegotiation. It may not be that far-reaching a renegotiation, but will certainly be puffed up into something rather more significant than it is. I think the problem for Cameron is that he has been a prisoner of the European issue rather than leading it, right from the time when he contested the Conservative Party leadership back in the mid-2000s. Where in order to head off the challenge of David Davis, in particular from the right of the Conservative Party, he made pledges on Europe, which were not really his beliefs, but a tactical positioning. To an extent, he's been a prisoner of that tactical positioning ever since, and he still is now, which is why he has to go forward with a referendum in which he doesn't really believe, but needs to have in order to maintain the unity of his party. He will campaign to stay in. His party may well have a very difficult time in retaining a united voice when that moment comes. SNP, the SNP's strength partly reflects that sense that it is going to be a far better defender of Scotland's interests in the UK than anyone else. It partly reflects a very, very skillful leadership renewal from Salmond, who resigned the day after the referendum, to Sturgeon, who's given the party a new launch, as it were, under her leadership, and she's been tremendously effective. What it will take for the SNP to be knocked off that position is change on both of those things, a sense that others, most likely the Labour Party, can defend Scotland's interests within the UK, which would mean a much more devolved or even independent Labour Party in Scotland, and they'll need to find a compelling leader, and they've gone through a few and they haven't found one yet.
Nigel Sharman, what is the nature of the deal that could be done between David Cameron and the Scottish Nationalists, given that the last thing the SNP probably wants right now is full fiscal autonomy?
Yes, full fiscal autonomy has receded from the urgent list of priorities for the SNP. That receding process has a direct correlation to the price of oil, I think. What I think the SNP would like is a bigger incremental move towards a stronger Scottish Parliament than is set out in the Smiths Commission report, with additional powers over taxation, possibly quite significantly additional, but with continuing transfers from the UK level to Scotland. Full fiscal autonomy is now seen as at the very least a medium-term initiative which will need to be smoothed by continuing integration into the system of UK fiscal transfers, otherwise known as having your cake and eating it. Now, that's still a deal which could be acceptable to the Conservatives if they really wish to institutionalise England in a way it has not been institutionalised in the UK political system through English votes on English laws. That is something which is extraordinarily complex. It's not simply a matter of tweaking parliamentary procedure. I think you have to think more fundamentally about how you do government business. And you have to think about England as a territorial unit. You have to organise your ministries in that way. You have to think about how you fund public policies in a much more systematic territorial basis. And you probably have to have a proper manifesto actually written down with a full raft of policies as compared to the thing that the Conservatives talked about in that election. But if you did that, you're likely to produce a political unit, England, in which the Conservatives have, for the foreseeable future, an inherent advantage. So there is a deal there, institutionalising that advantage for the Conservatives, while continuing to fund Scotland as its powers get enhanced. I could see that deal, and I went to a Conservative Party conference, it's probably about 7 or 8 years ago now, suggesting to them that was an obvious thing for them to be thinking about. I don't think they've shown the creativity of thought yet. Perhaps now is the time.
Thank you. John Binks. Do you think that David Cameron's going to come to regret the passing of the Fixed Term Parliament Act?
That was a really big issue had there not been an absolute majority, because it could have been difficult to construct a stable arrangement without an overall majority for any one political party, and the Act could then have been an obstacle to moving forward with perhaps a new election. Cameron may come to regret that because his lead is not a big one. Somebody will be awkward enough to die and cause a by-election, and cuts will begin to bite and you'll get an anti-conservative protest, and Europe might produce a few rebels who refuse to support. So a couple of years in, that majority may no longer in effect exist. And what Cameron would need in those circumstances to call a new election is a two-thirds majority in Parliament. In other words, Labour would need to vote with the Conservatives. Now, if I were whoever it is, Andy Burnham perhaps, seeing a Conservative Party struggling with itself on Europe and other matters, would I consent to an election or would I string it out? Well, I think I know what I would do.
Gavin Ure, I believe that during the election, the other parties in Scotland, apart from the SNP, were frustrated that any criticisms they levied against the SNP as the government in Scotland seemed to have no effect upon voters at all. Is that likely to change as we lead up to the Holyrood elections next year, where this might be more relevant?
You're very right. there is a sense that the SNP has got away with a number of public policy failings. For example, outcomes on education are not improving. You could look at all sorts of health outcome indicators and say that things are not improving. Reforms to the organisation of the police have proved unpopular. So all sorts of issues of record on which the SNP could be challenged, and indeed parties were saying it's very unfair that people are not recognising this. Do we blame the SNP for that, or do we blame those parties for that? What's been striking about the Scottish Parliament in the last few years is how ineffective the opposition has been, how the opposition parties have not been at all creative in using the Parliament as a platform for opposition, doing creative things with parliamentary procedure. Their heart's not been in it, and that's given the SNP a very easy ride, and I think the SNP will continue to have a very easy ride until those opposition parties start doing some proper opposing. And I have to say, the Labour Party in Scotland, as well as at the UK level, is going to be consumed for the next period in its own leadership battle, and it's probably not going to be doing any of that. So in the run-up to the next election, I think the SNP could have a continuation of that easy ride.
One final question.
Nick Thompson, no affiliation. Do you think the damage caused by the referendum can ever be repaired, or if you think it can be repaired, how many years will that take? I certainly felt a feeling when I was in Scotland last year of almost a hatred for the English, and then on the English side almost coming out and thinking, Scotland don't like us, why should we bother with Scotland? And by the way, my mother's Scottish, my father's English.
I'm an Englishman in Scotland. The referendum created a yes-no situation where people didn't think themselves to be in a yes-no position. I think there is a wider spectrum of views than independence or not. I think there's probably a very clear majority in Scotland for a parliament that is significantly stronger than the one we have, but which is within the UK, but that wasn't an option last year. So I think people were forced into, in a sense, an artificial polarisation, and that left quite a few bruises in Scotland, and I think elsewhere in the UK, especially in England, perhaps most especially in amongst those of Scottish heritage in England, who didn't feel that they were given a stake in what for them was a quite fundamental issue. I don't think the issues have been resolved. The Scottish constitutional question is still live, and it will continue to have reverberations. There's a challenge of statesmanship there, I guess, which Prime Minister Cameron and First Minister Sturgeon have an opportunity to address. Let's see if they take it.
Thank you very much. Charlie, thank you for another illuminating conversation. You've got your tie, so your continued depletion of the FCC's inventory.
Absolutely.
We'd like to present you with some of our correspondence notebook. Thank you very much. And thank you all for joining us, and we look forward to seeing you all again back at the FCC soon. Thank you.